Today on Pilgrim Radio's His People, Stan Diddams, helping bring hope to people living in the Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya, Africa.
They often don't even have citizenship or, you know, any documentation to prove that they're, you know, they're sort of homeless in the worst possible sense, not even having a country to live in. So, I mean, it's sort of the worst of all possible worlds, and just to me kind of exemplifies the kind of people that God would like us to be looking out for and giving our attention to.
Stan Diddams, next. After retiring from your career of 38 years, you might not typically think you'd shortly find yourself working in a refugee camp in Africa. But that's exactly what happened to Stan Diddams following his retirement from Bank of America. He also recently completed the requirements for an MA degree in Humanitarian and Disaster Leadership at Wheaton College. He's on the board of directors for the International Association for Refugees, or IAFR, and he's on the advisory board of World Relief. Today, I'll be talking to him about his time at the refugee camp he described in the article, A Week in Kakuma Refugee Camp, Glimpses of Hope. Mr. Diddams, for starters, what can you tell us about the Kakuma Refugee Camp?
Sure. The camp is located in northwest Kenya. It is in a relatively unwelcoming part of the country. You know, no surprise that the refugees would be deposited, if you will, in a particular area of the country that was really not attractive. It is near the Sudan border, the South Sudan border, also borders Uganda, Ethiopia, and Somalia. And, you know, if you think about those countries, and the news that has come out of those countries over the last, you know, two or three decades, you will quickly realize those are all countries that have had war, tribal conflict, internal conflict, and so forth. So Kakuma is close to several countries that have been plagued by war and conflict. And because of that, it has been a refuge for people fleeing those conflicts.
When roughly was this refugee camp formed, and how many are there currently?
It was formed in 1992. It was initially just informally formed, I guess you would say, because there were refugees coming from South Sudan primarily at that time, who just showed up, started camping along the banks of a seasonal river there, and after some thousands of them showed up, the UNHCR, the UN High Commission for Refugees, realized that they had a problem. They needed to provide, you know, basics for all these people. And so the UNHCR established a camp in 92. It's grown to today to have a population of around 240,000 people. Hmm. So it's the size of a small city, really. If you were to look at it, it looks a lot like what you might have seen in large, poor countries, kind of a slum sort of vibe to it, you know, sort of a shanty town kind of buildings made of corrugated metal and plastic sheeting and brush and so forth, all very densely crammed together. And 240,000 people call this place home, and it is still growing in population.
What is life like in the Kakuma refugee camp? 240,000 people. You said numerous African nations have fed into it, so presumably, there are many different languages. They can't all communicate.
You know, unlike we Americans, these people they tend to be multilingual, but yes, there are multiple countries represented and languages spoken. That just to give you a sense that the number one population in Kakuma is the South Sudanese. They account for over half of the population there. And that's really because of the fact that Sudan was in civil war for literally a half a century following World War II, up to about 10 years ago or so. And then it split into Sudan and South Sudan. So then, promptly after that split, South Sudan went into a civil war and has had tribal warfare ongoing from then till now, to varying degrees. So the Sudanese make up over half. Then there are Somalians that are the next most common, and then people from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which it has an ongoing civil war, and then Burundi and Ethiopia are the next two. And then there are a smattering of people from a few other countries. But the people come from these war-torn areas. They often will have seen family members killed, seen their homes destroyed, burned to the ground. In some cases, they've been recruited as, and forced into to be soldiers in wars that they're not interested in being in. In some cases, they've been trafficked, raped, etc. So these people are coming in a world of hurt. They're traumatized, and so they are. They're happy simply to have a secure place where they can have a simple shelter and hopefully recover. And so, that's really what life is about. Their life is fairly proscribed. I mean, the rules say they can't go out and work in the country, in Kenya. And so they can sometimes pick up a little work working for the NGOs in the camp or starting their own small businesses, perhaps make a little extra money, but they're given the basics and food and water and shelter and schooling and healthcare. But they're very confined, and it's very difficult for them to see ways that they can improve their situation. Partly because, frankly, the UN doesn't want the refugee camps to be attractive places. If they make them too attractive, then more people will come. I mean, the countries around, as I said, are they're poor countries. They're in conflict. The UNHCR doesn't want to start doing things to make it nice, only to have the unintended consequences of having more people flood into the refugee camp. So it's this odd kind of environment where it's kind of a crummy place, but it's sort of intentionally kept that way, and people are sort of stuck there in this long-term yet temporary kind of location. It's really very sad.
And you said the rules don't permit them to work outside of the camp in the surrounding Kenya. There are rules then that as you become part of the refugee situation there that you have to agree to.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, they. I mean, they have. They're issued. Many of them don't have passports, or any identity papers of any kind. But when they come into the camp, they're registered. They get a refugee identification card. If they were to go try to, Kenya just simply doesn't want the competition. They don't want refugees coming in and competing for jobs in their own country with their own citizens. I mean, you can kind of see that. Obviously, the United States feels that way as well. So that's the situation. So they're very confined in what they can do.
And as far as who supports it, it's the United Nations that actually provides the security, provides the food, and so forth.
Yes, United Nations High Commission for Refugees operates the camp and is responsible for those basic provisions, although they don't directly provide it. They hire contractors to do this, to do most of the work. And the contractors tend to be religious-based organizations, mostly Christian-based organizations. The Lutheran World Federation, there's an organization that we partner with on our trip to Kakuma called National Council of Churches Kenya. There's the Jesuit Refugee Services, et cetera, et cetera. There are multiple NGOs that have a Christian foundation that are there.
Are there specifically Christian ministries that we would be familiar with there, like a World Vision, Compassion International, something like that?
Not that I'm aware of. World Vision, when you're in the camp, World Vision does sort of long-term development work, right? They would go into a village in a remote place that is poor. They would improve the, you know, water and sanitation, and the help people to grow better crops and, you know, healthcare, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. So that's what they do. That's really not what the, they're not allowed to do that kind of thing in the refugee camp. So see, that's the irony of it. If this were not a refugee camp, you would, no doubt would have world vision and multiple other organizations saying, let's, you know, make this a better place, but that's not allowed. So all you can do, all the NGOs can do is provide the very basic services.
And ironically, as you said, they keep it intentionally sort of a little bit on the margins so that people do not get too comfortable, so they don't see it as a long-term solution. And yet, I think in your article, you say that there are, in some cases, generations of families that end up there. They want to look at it as just sort of you're passing through for a while to maybe, as you say, to be a refugee for a while, but it's not so easy to go back.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I keep looking in the news to see if perhaps the civil war in South Sudan is slowing down, is simmering down, to see if the conflict in Somalia is slowing down. It doesn't seem to be. Ethiopia, you know, Tigray, there's some hope of a peace there. Perhaps some of the Ethiopians could go back if that holds, you know. But in general, people have been there long term because the number one solution for them is repatriation to their country, and their country is still not safe. And so they would rather stay in this kind of miserable environment than go back to an unsafe place that they came from.
My guest today on His People is Mr. Stan Diddams. He retired from Bank of America after 38 years. He's fulfilled his requirements for an MA degree in humanitarian and disaster leadership at Wheaton College. And we're talking about his article, A Week in Kakuma Refugee Camp, Glimpses of Hope. Well, tell us, Mr. Diddams, why it is that you went to the refugee camp. What did you do there?
I went as a part of a team of four people with International Association for Refugees, which you mentioned earlier that I'm on the board of. And the purpose of the trip was to respond to requests from a local multi-church organization for pastoral education and for a livelihoods program. What IAFR tries to do is partner with local churches, local organizations, where refugees are, and essentially take their priorities to be IFR's priorities. And so in a process of many years of working with local pastors in Kakuma, they have expressed interest in theological education, trauma care education, and more recently in helping their women to start small businesses so they can earn a little extra income. And so the trauma care training, theological training have been ongoing over several years. So IFR has brought theology professors, psychology professors to Kakuma to provide training to the pastors. The pastors organization, by the way, is over 160 churches.
Refugee camp.
Yes, in the refugee camp, and also a few in the surrounding community. Mm-hmm. The local Turkana tribe is nearby. But the idea, I was there specifically to assess the need for the program to help women with small businesses, to do a little training, a little listening on starting small businesses. And so that was my primary role. There were also just meetings, sort of strategic meetings with the pastor's organization. There was also a dedication of a building that IFR assisted them to build, which houses classrooms for children's summer sort of VBS type programs and Christian education for the pastors as well. So it was a little bit of a mix of all those things involved in the trip.
So you had a sort of played a role in helping women there, at least some of them start, I think some people have called it micro enterprise, is that right? Or helping them to start small businesses? Did I understand that correctly?
Yes, that's right. That is the objective. We're early in the process. The request, certainly to help with that kind of thing is loud and clear. We were there to try to understand more operationally, more practically, how could we partner with them to make this happen? And part of that was meetings with women. We had two separate meetings with a total of about 140 women to listen to them and have them tell us what they wanted to do, what kind of businesses they thought would make sense in their neighborhood, in their market, or whatever. So that was part of the process. With development work or with this kind of work, microenterprise work in a foreign culture, I mean, their culture is so different from ours, and their understanding of money and business is so different from ours. And so it's going to be a slow process. I would say, I would love to, as an American, go in and accomplish a lot in a short period of time, but we have to be patient. We started the process in this trip, got a lot of good feedback. I think I had some good conversations with our partners, and we'll continue pushing ahead, to hopefully get to a program that makes sense for them.
Do you plan to go back?
I hope so. Yes, this is my second trip, I should
Oh.
say. The first one was in March of 2020.
Okay.
So this, yeah.
Now, does your background, your extensive background in what you did in banking, does that come into play? In other words, does the Lord use that? Is the Lord using that part of your story, your background in what you're doing here with the refugees in Kakuma?
Yes, I mean, I spent my whole career in a lending environment, mostly lending to larger businesses, but the principles apply, and certainly that's helpful. I also did a lot of research, as a part of this, just in preparation for going to Kakuma and trying to get a livelihoods program started. I read a number of books and just did my research to get up to speed on what it means to practice microenterprise in a completely different cultural environment. So, but my background is certainly helpful to some degree.
And certainly, most of us would have no understanding of what you said a couple of minutes ago, how different the cultures are. I'm trying to bridge that between the culture of the Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya and the culture that we all know here in the United States, or at least most of the people that are listening to this are in the U.S. Can you help us to understand maybe what some of those cultural differences look like?
Yeah, one thing that we have to be very conscious of is that we want the local organization to be in a position to take the lead. I mean, we're sitting here in the US, thousands of miles away. There's no way we can possibly run some sort of micro lending program in a refugee camp that we only visit perhaps once a year or something, right? So they need to take the lead. And yet, when we go there, just because of the dominant, white European American culture, anything we say, they're going to have a tendency to agree with. They're going to nod their heads. They're going to say, yes, whatever I say, whatever this guy Diddums, the former banker says, that's what we're going to agree to. But we don't really want that. So the what we're trying to do is be much more sensitive to where they're coming from and try to be active listeners, try to pull out from them what they think is really important and what they think the issues are, what they already know that they're not telling us, So there's that whole communication dynamic that I think is one of the biggest cultural differences. And they tend to have a communication style that's known to be high context. In other words, if they say something in one context, it means one thing, and they say something in another context, it means another thing. So it's difficult. We have to be very attentive to sort of reading between the lines and understanding what's behind the words rather than just taking things at face value.
So there is English being spoken.
Yes, definitely. Our meetings with the leadership are in English. There was It's when I say the leadership, think of a group of six or seven senior pastors that are leading this group of 160 churches. One of them did not speak English very well, and we had a translator for that, but the others spoke English reasonably well. When we went to the meetings with the women, they were definitely translators, and in one case, two translators, because the women are not that proficient in English. Most of them, they spoke Swahili and Arabic in most cases. So in some meetings, translation; in others, not.
So what were some of the most meaningful memories or situations that you had that, as you look back on it?
The thing that sticks the most in my mind is the worship service that I participated in. And I was warned in advance, fortunately, that I would be expected to preach. This is apparently common for any Westerners that are going to Kakuma partner, you know, to work with this organization of churches, that they will invite us, every member of the team, whether you're a preacher or not, to go and preach in their churches. So the four of us were divided up and went to four separate churches. And the church service that I went to was just wonderful. It was 2.5 hours. The pastor told me right at the beginning what the order of the service was. And I remember distinctly there was a singing part of the service, and then later there was a dancing part of the service, which one doesn't see that often in an American church. I thought it was actually wonderful. And they were very enthusiastic and very spirit-filled Christians in that church worshiping God, and a lot of joy in the face of the circumstances that I mentioned earlier. So, you know, I think we should not think of them as being people that God has forgotten. We should not think of them certainly as people that are being punished, you know, for something. They are loved by God. Mm-hmm. They're joyful in their worship, and they find hope in their faith. And so that worship service was probably the best example of hope amongst the church in Kakuma.
Well, there's so much to ask you, of course, about the Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya, and thank you for giving us such a feel for it. I mean, at least in terms of as much as we can in a short conversation, where you have 240,000 people living in a refugee camp in an African nation, in the refugee camp composed of people from various nations. But you retired, as we mentioned at the beginning, from 38 years in the banking industry. If I can ask you, how did the Lord lead you to pursue this particular degree? Perhaps people haven't heard of a degree in humanitarian and disaster leadership. How do you sense Him leading you in that respect?
Well, it really started with the first trip that I had to Kakuma. It was in the beginning of March of 2020, and just before everything kind of closed down for the pandemic. Mm-hmm. But at that time, I was just invited mainly as an observer to learn and see what was going on in Kakuma as a guest of IAFR. And so I went on that trip, you know, after seeing the refugee camp, after meeting with the local organization. I'd say God started nudging me that, hey, this is something that you need to think about. And that was influential in my next decision, which was to go back to school and get my master's in humanitarian disaster leadership at Wheaton. So I actually applied within about a month after coming back from Kakuma. Thank goodness, by the way, for me, the pandemic was kind of a blessing, because for my job, I used to travel weekly almost, and travel was no longer being done. So I had some time in the evenings and was able to contemplate doing this online program. So I applied to and began the HDL program at Wheaton in August of 2020, so just a few months after the trip to Kakuma, and completed that program here just recently. That first trip really led to the second trip, and also led to, I guess, people starting to hear that I was interested in refugees, led to World Relief inviting me to be on their advisory board, and has led to other inquiries and things that you know, wouldn't have come up otherwise. So I got to hand it to God for, you know, being instrumental in taking me on that trip as a pure observer initially, and sort of prodding me to get myself better educated. And now I don't really know where this is going to take me. I'm just trying to be humble and to listen. And when people come to me and say, hey, could you do this or could you do that? You know, because we understand you're interested in refugees, I'm trying to say yes. And that's really what I'm doing.
How did you get interested in refugees? You're on the board of directors of the International Association for Refugees.
I wouldn't say I really was until just the last couple of years. If you think about it, though, I mean, the Bible certainly tells us, has this theme throughout of caring for people that are on the margins, the widows, the orphans, the poor. I mean, and if you think about it, who better exemplifies that than refugees? I mean, they're often traumatized, they're poor, they often don't even have citizenship or, you know, any documentation to prove that they're, you know, they're sort of homeless in the worst possible sense, not even having a country to live in. So, I mean, it's sort of the worst of all possible worlds, and just to me kind of exemplifies the kind of people that God would like us to be looking out for and giving our attention to and supporting. And so, you know, I have a little bit of a balanced portfolio, if you will. I'm with IAFR, which primarily works with refugees outside the U.S., where they're located in places like Kakuma and around the world. And then I also have World Relief, which takes inbound refugees coming to the U.S. Who are being placed here, and World Relief kind of upholds them and supports them through the first few months of their resettlement in the U.S. And so I get to work with refugees, I support refugees both abroad and here at home.
Mr. Diddams, I know our time is nearly up today, but you wrote the piece, A Week in Kakuma Refugee Camp, Glimpses of Hope. What were those glimpses of hope?
You know, when refugees come to Kakuma and they have nothing and they're traumatized, it is interesting to see that one of the first things they do is they find a congregation, they find a group of Christians to worship with. You know, what that makes me realize is that our worship, our faith, is really the main thing that gives us hope. I mean, we may not recognize that in a wealthy country that we live in, but if you don't have anything, that's what you cling to. That's what you put as your top priority. And you will see people in Kakuma who have arrived recently meeting under a tree, 50 or 100 people, for a worship service and praising God and singing. And that gives me hope. That's a sign of hope, even in very terrible circumstances.
You've been listening to His People on Pilgrim Radio. Many thanks to our guest, Stan Diddams, who recently retired from 38 years with Bank of America. You can read his piece, A Week in Kakuma Refugee Camp, Glimpses of Hope, by going to ChristianityToday.com. Thanks for listening, and I hope you can join us again on Monday at this same time for another edition of His People.